History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that should never go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're just weeks away now from the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and you'll be hearing a lot about that on TV and radio and everywhere else. But this week marked a different anniversary that may have snuck past you. And that's going to be the focus of our program this week. April 18th marked the 82nd anniversary of one of the most creative, courageous, and daring endeavors of World War II, the unprecedented launch of B-25s from the USS Hornet to bomb Tokyo on April 18th, 1942, known, of course, as the Doolittle Raid. None of the men who flew that mission are with us anymore, but we're going to hear the memories of one of them, as well as a nurse who cared for some of the raiders when they came home. But first, here's the observation of an eyewitness. Al Bloomer was aboard the USS Enterprise that was traveling toward Japan alongside the Hornet for that historic strike. The Big E had been out to sea when Pearl Harbor was hit and responded to the aftermath, and this was just 4 months later.
And we didn't know where we was going, and we was out there about the second day, and here come the Hornet with a whole bunch of B-25s on the flight deck. And we said, where in the hell are we going to go with them? How are they going to get off? We never dreamed that they were going to launch it from that carrier. But anyway, we kept going, and then the old admiral comes on to the public speaking system. He tells us what we're going to do. He says, we're going to go in within 500 miles of Japan, and we're going to launch these B-25s. And we said, boy. And when we started the day that we was going to launch those things, it was got rough. Was going up and down and so forth. But the day before, that it was so rough, that they decided to leave the destroyers back because they could not keep up with the larger ships going to make a run in to launch those aircraft. And so the smallest ship we had was a light cruiser, and they had the 6-inch guns on it. That's the older style ones. They didn't have the brand new ones like they had now. Anyway, we get there, and about 10 o'clock in the morning or something, I hear gun firing. And then I hear General Quarters, and I said, oh, we're in trouble now. But anyway, that's when they run into these sandpans about 650 miles outside of Japan. That light cruiser was shooting them. The dive bombers were trying to bomb them, and the old fighters were trying to strafe them so they wouldn't get the message off. And then pretty soon you ran into another one. And I said, oh, boy, and here goes the same old routine again. So they decide to launch the aircraft. They was going to launch them, and the guys on the gun group, he says, I'll bet you $20 they don't make it. Yeah, I'll take five of that. You know, and then another guy gambling that. You know there's no gambling on Navy ships. But anyway, that's the way it goes. And we watched them, and they decide to launch. We watched them, and that old Hornet would go up when it hit those waves, goes down. And what they would try to do on the up side, they timed it where the B-25s would take off. And then lo and behold, the first one, of course, was Doolittle himself, and he's a good pilot, man. He roared that thing up, and you could almost see it. And then it moved like that, and it went right on off. And then one of them didn't put his flaps out or something. And we said, uh-oh, he's going in. He's going way down. They couldn't even see him. And we couldn't see him either because the ship. And all of a sudden, he appeared back up again, every one of them. And I read where it took an hour and 1 minute to launch all those 16 B-25s off of that carrier. And then after that, boy, you know, we turned around and we got out of there as fast as we could. Well, I heard rumors. I don't know how true it is, but I heard they thought we wasn't going to be able to launch an aircraft. They were thinking that we was going to launch our own aircraft, and they had to begin about 100 or 200 miles before you get to Japan, and they were setting up a trap for us. They never dreamed that it was going to be those B-25. But anyway, we got out of there, and we all survived.
And you had the best seat in the house, it sounds like. I mean, this is something that's never, ever happened before in history that a lot of people said was impossible. You guys on your ship are betting they're not going to get off the deck of that Hornet. And you sat there and watched all 16 of those B-25s take off?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I stood on the starboard side there, and I could stand on my 5-inch gun up there, and I could look over there and see them, watch them. They all take off.
When you're watching that, are you wondering what's going to happen to them?
Yeah, I sure did. Of course, I never knew until afterwards. They never told us. And you know, too, on the way back there, that task force, they said, "Now listen, this is a secret." And they said, "If any of you guys say anything about where those B-25s come from, you're going to be put in prison, and you're going to be making big rocks at the little ones the rest of your life." So I want you. And you believe it or not, I never did hear of anybody that told where those came from during my whole time during the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the Navy, until after it was really publicized. And the fact, too, that you didn't even get it put on your record at that time. You never got credit for it. But anyway, things got straightened up later on.
And now there's more information out there about the Doolittle Raid than you'd have time to read over the rest of your lifetime. But there's nothing quite like hearing it from someone who lived it. And David Thatcher was one of them. Years ago, I had the privilege of sitting down with him in Missoula, Montana. One of the first things I asked the Montana native is how long he waited to enlist in the Army Air Corps after graduating from high school there.
A year and a half after high school.
So that was pretty close to when Pearl Harbor happened that you enlisted.
A year and 4 days before Pearl Harbor.
A lot of people that ended up in the Army Air Corps tell me that they went into that branch of service because they wanted to be a pilot. Was that your story?
I just wanted to get into airplanes, yes.
You just wanted to fly one way or another. So tell me about where you were when Pearl Harbor happened. I imagine you probably already started doing quite a bit of training by then.
I was in Lincoln, Nebraska, going to airplane mechanic school. I was there when Pearl Harbor happened, there until the 19th of December, 1941.
What do you remember about that day, about December 7th? Do you remember where you were when you found out and what it felt like, what it meant to you at the time?
It was Sunday afternoon. We had gone to a movie. We came out of the movie and heard about them.
Did you immediately realize that this isn't a game anymore? There's going to be some real action real soon?
No, things didn't seem to be much different.
But they would be in a few months. And in fact, it was only 2 weeks after that, the way I understand it, that President Roosevelt first said, had the idea of a strike on the Japanese mainland, which Japan was telling its people could not happen. And then a few months after that, someone came up with the idea of flying bombers off of aircraft carriers. But I imagine you didn't know anything about any of that, right?
That's right, yeah.
Tell me about how you got assigned to your squadron and what your understanding was about what you guys were going to do.
Well, I was in the 95th Bombardment Squadron of the 17th Bomb Group, and that was the first group in the U.S. Army Air Corps to begin training in B-25s. So all the Raiders were picked out of that group. They had had more training than any other group in the Army Air Corps at that time.
And so you got assigned as a gunner on a B-25. Where on the plane were you?
I was on a machine gun turret on top of the airplane.
Now, the original B-25 had another gun turret, but by the time you guys ended up overseas, that was going to be a little different. But when did you, the way I understand it, at some point someone went around and said, "We need volunteers for a dangerous mission that we can't tell you about." Is that what you remember, or was it a little different?
Well, I wanted to do some flying. I was just a mechanic on the ground, so I volunteered for this crew, but had no idea where we're going to go or what we're going to do.
Did they give you any kind of warning that the transition from mechanic to gunner might make things a little more dangerous, put you in harm's way a little more?
None whatever.
Would you have been worried about it anyway?
No, I'm sure I would not have.
All right, so here you are. It's early 1942. You guys end up training and some top secret training in Florida, as I understand. From what I hear, they marked the runway to mimic what an aircraft carrier would have been in terms of length to figure out if a B-25 could actually take off and land in that short of a distance?
Yes, that was at Eglin Field in Florida. We did not make any of those fancy takeoffs at the main base because we didn't want anyone to see what we were doing. They had an auxiliary field out in the timber. That's where they had the runway marked off in certain distances.
So by this time, are you starting to get a clue that something's up here, that you guys are doing something very unique?
Yes, especially since we had a Navy pilot from Pensacola checking out all the pilots. He had flown off an aircraft carrier to see if they could get off in a certain distance.
And I imagine by this time, too, in addition to a Navy pilot, there is a pilot by the name of Doolittle who you'd run across once or twice. Did you guys know who he was? Was he a big deal yet?
Yes, I remember in peacetime that he'd won some trophies flying. And he came down there we first met him at Eglin. He came and introduced us, and he was supposed to be our commander.
What kind of guy was he? Because obviously there's been a lot written about him. He's been portrayed in the movies. You've been portrayed in the movies. But how would you describe Jimmy Doolittle as a human being?
Well, he was pretty short. He's probably one of the shortest guys on the raid. But he's very efficient. He not only knew all about airplanes, but about the engines and every part of them.
Now, by this time, while you're training in Florida, did you have the crew that you would end up flying with on the ruptured duck? Were you already intact as a crew at that point?
Yes. Went down there with that crew and began training with that crew all the time.
And your pilot on that crew, Ted Lawson, was actually born in Fresno, believe it or not. And he, of course, wrote the book, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, that turned into a movie. How close were you with him? And did you guys appreciate his skills in the cockpit?
Yes, we did. It was a very close, knit crew. So we all knew each other very well. So.
And was it around this time that your plane was dubbed the Ruptured Duck? Because I understand at first it didn't have any nose art or any name on the nose.
There was originally six crew on the crew, but one crew, when they took all the radio equipment out, they wouldn't need a radio gunner or so. But one day he was out there and used some chalk and drew a picture of Donald Duck bandaged up with a couple of crutches. So then that was just in chalk, but soon after that, the other crews nicknamed the plane the Ruptured Duck. So.
It had gotten banged up on a practice landing or something a little bit to lead to that nickname, or is that not true?
None whatever, huh?
So that's one of the myths. See, this is what I love about talking to someone who was actually there. You can expose the myths and find out what was really true about your crew. Now, you mentioned taking the radio equipment out, and that brings me to another important question, because you had trained in B-25s, and then you're starting to see, well, they're changing these B-25s. Tell me about some of the modifications that were made to these planes, and if that started to pique your curiosity a little bit.
Well, before the planes went down to Columbia, South Carolina, they were at Minneapolis. They took the bottom turret out because we knew we would be flying so low that no enemy fighter could get underneath of us, and we wouldn't need oxygen, so they took all that weight out, the oxygen tanks and all that, and just about all the radio equipment, because we had to fly silent all the time. So,
because that was such a top-secret mission, you didn't want to be detected. And the other thing, the thing they added to the plane, were pretend guns pointing backwards, decoy guns that weren't real, and also gas tanks, just about doubled the fuel capacity, right?
Yeah, in the place at the bottom turret, they put a 60-gallon leak-proof tank in there that if a bullet goes through it, it'll self-seal. In the top of the bomb bay, they put a tank in there, over 100 gallons, it was leak-proof also, and there was still room for 400 or 500-pound bombs below the tank.
Now, forgive me for asking a really dumb question, because I think the listeners would rather hear your explanation than mine. Why were they doing all this? Why were they changing the plane so much? What was the purpose of all these modifications?
For long-distance flying.
So you lengthened the distance that the plane would be able to fly, and you also had to be able to take off on an aircraft carrier. Which, did you find that out? When did you find that out, that you guys were expected to take off and land on an aircraft carrier in a bomber?
They didn't tell us. We just figured it out ahead of time. We figured that for that training, it would be taking off an aircraft carrier, and we thought where else would be going but Japan. So.
And it, as far as I understand, it still remains the only time that Air Force or Army Air Corps planes took off from a Navy carrier, right?
No, they practiced it off the coast of Virginia. They put two lightweight airplanes on board and make sure they could get off.
But the only time in an actual mission that it happened. So they send you from Florida, and you head west briefly to Sacramento, then to Alameda, and then they finally do put you on an aircraft carrier. Of course, everyone knows it was the USS Hornet. Tell me about what that was like when you actually got on the ship with these planes. There's 16 planes. There's 80 crew members. It's a pretty small unit to be taking on a pretty big task.
Well, they put extra gasoline in. There's a crawlway on the, above the bomb bay between there and on top of the airplane, just large enough to crawl from the back end to the front end. So they put a collapsible rubber tank in there that held over 100 gallons. And then after I got in on the airplane, they handed me up a dozen five-gallon cans of gasoline, so I had that in the back with me. When we flew from Sacramento then to Alameda, and on the way we flew under the Oakland Bay Bridge and pulled up to the dock right beside the Hornet.
So did all the planes fly under the bridge, or was that Lawson's trick?
I don't think any of the others did.
How'd the rest of you feel about that? Were you applauding them or telling them he was crazy?
No, I enjoyed it.
I talked to a B-24 pilot once who flew under the Golden Gate Bridge, so you're right up there with him. Once you get on the Hornet and you see how many of you there are, you know what the training has been, you know this is going to be a dangerous mission. Are you excited? You a little nervous? You scared? What's going through your mind?
When they pulled up the dock beside the carrier, then they just hoisted the airplane up on the deck, and I stayed in the plane so I could lock the brakes when they set it down on the deck of the carrier. So I did not walk aboard, and I did not walk off the carrier.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are 16 pilots in this group of Raiders.
They had extra pilots and crews in case someone got sick or something like that.
But of the pilots that were expected to take off of an aircraft carrier, how many of them had ever taken off in a bomber from an aircraft carrier before?
None of them.
And that's one of the reasons we refer to the Doolittle Raid as unprecedented. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, David Thatcher's memories of one of the most daring and incredible missions in American aviation history unfolding 82 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode commemorating the 82nd anniversary of the Doolittle Raid, launched on April 18, 1942. David Thatcher ended up one of the last two survivors of that mission. When we first heard his story on Hometown Heroes, there were a few more than that. And back in 1942, they had left San Francisco Bay in early April on their historic quest to strike back against Imperial Japan.
We had the Hornet and then two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. There was just eight in the task force when they left there. And we got just out of San Francisco a ways, and then they announced over the loudspeaker that our destination was Japan. And there was a huge shout went up over the whole aircraft carrier. No one had said anything about where we were going up until then.
Had you had your suspicions that it might be Japan? I'm sure that's where everyone wanted to attack.
we thought that's where we'd be going, yes.
Anything of note that stands out to you between when you left the Golden Gate and when you got to that morning of April 18th when the mission actually happened?
The Navy wasn't very well pleased with having Army personnel aboard, but after they treated us pretty well, they let me sleep in a bed instead of a hammock.
So you get closer and closer to April 18th, and as I understand it, the events of that day actually got triggered sooner than they were supposed to. Surprise, surprise. Funny how that happens in war. Tell me how that developed.
Before that, we met up with another small task force, and it had the carrier Enterprise. It also had two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. And Hornet could not launch or recover its aircraft while we were on board. So they had the Enterprise along to try and protect the task force from aerial fighting.
And that's a pretty good security blanket. You know what the Big E went on to do the rest of the war and had been there at Pearl Harbor, outside the harbor too. Well, let's move along to that morning, April 18th. Did you have any butterflies that day? How much did you know about what you guys were going to be doing? Walk us through that day as you experienced it.
Well, we knew what our target was. Each of the pilots got a chance to pick what target they wanted. So, and our target was the Nippon Steel Factory in Tokyo. But that morning, we heard the sort of explosion, guns going off, and immediately they announced over the loudspeaker, "Army pilots, man your plane." So we had to get ready and go up on deck.
Did that get your blood pumping a little bit, get you excited?
Yes, it did.
I can imagine how it would. And as I understand it, Doolittle made the decision to leave 10 hours earlier because your task force had been detected. So this added 170 miles on a range that was already at its limit, right?
And I think Bull Hall pretty much made the decision that as long as we'd run into a Japanese fishing boat out there, that we're afraid they'd warn Japan that there was a task force out there. So we had to take off then.
What was it like on your crew as you guys took off? Did you have any idea how historic a mission this was going to be?
None whatever. We figured just another bombing mission.
But this is obviously your first mission.
Yes, for every one of us, yes.
So you weren't nervous at all?
Just pretty excited and had to concentrate on what we were doing, yes.
And what were your duties? I know the plane had 400 or 500 pound bombs, but you're on that top turret gun, so are you just looking for enemy aircraft to shoot at, or what?
I would just keep a lookout. I had 250 caliber machine guns in the turret, and I could see everything from up there in all directions, so I had a ringside seat.
So I've heard these B-25s, these heavily modified B-25s, described as flying gas cans. Was that something that you guys used as a characterization, or something that you've heard since?
Probably something heard since.
But you knew that crazy mission, that you were not going to make it back to the ship. Was that clear to you beforehand?
No way of ever coming back to the ship. We couldn't land on the aircraft carrier. We just had to go ahead.
So you were hoping to drop your bombs over Tokyo and land somewhere. And tell me about how this played out.
Well, we were flying just 50 feet over the water. As we came in over the beach, it was Saturday, right at noon, a beautiful day. And there's hundreds of people along the beach. So as we flew overhead, they were waving to us. I could see the expressions on their faces as they were cheering. I'm sure they thought we were Japanese planes. After we left the coast, then before we got to Tokyo, we met a formation of six planes. But we were flying so low that it's difficult to see an airplane that's flying right over the ground. With the olive drab color they were, and they passed over ahead, and I guess they didn't even see us. They just kept on going the direction they were coming.
But you saw them. You knew they were coming, so you were probably at the ready on your 50 calibers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then before we got to Tokyo, we could see the anti-aircraft fire exploding because we did not go in formation. We went in alone. So six of the other airplanes had been ahead of us, so they drew the anti-aircraft fire. Then we had to climb to 1,500 feet to drop our bombs so they wouldn't blow us out of the air when they exploded. We had three 500-pound demolition and one 500-pound incendiary cluster. The three 500-pound demolition went at an angle down to the target, but the incendiary cluster, when it fell out of the airplane, it scattered into 126 individual bombs. So to scatter over the area that had been exploded from the other bomb, so to start fires. There wasn't too, there was quite a bit of anti-aircraft fire over Tokyo itself, but it wasn't very accurate. I guess they hadn't had any practice yet.
Well, yeah, they, I mean, just like Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack, a surprise attack, this was every bit as much a surprise attack, and there were probably a lot of people, like you said, that thought they were Japanese planes. But I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and in your head, and you're already flying this flying gas can, as I said, with a range that it's not designed to make. You can't come back to the ship. You don't know where you're going to land. You see six planes coming at you. You know there's probably more. It sounds a lot like a suicide mission. Did that ever occur to you that this might be a suicide mission?
No, we didn't plan on that at all. We figured we could reach China all right, even though we had to take off 250 miles farther out than we'd planned to. Our original plan was to take off in the evening and fly over Japan at night and reach China the next morning after daylight. As it was, we had to take off at 9 in the morning. We rode over Japan in the daytime and then finally arrived in on the coast of China. It was about dark.
I'm really intrigued by that period of time between when you dropped the bombs and when you landed, or crash landed as the case happened to be. When, at what point did you realize this is it? The gas has run out, or we've got to put it down. Was there any discussion among the crew? Did you guys just all trust Lawson to handle it, or what were those moments like?
No, we figured he could handle it, whether we tried to land in the water or fly up high and bail out.
When did you find out that he was going to put it in the water, that this was it? And tell our listeners where that was and how that all happened.
Well, we finally reached what we saw land, and he spotted a strip of beach, and he thought they could set it down there. So we had the wheel down, but it was almost dark and raining, and visibility was poor. And we hit the water with the wheel down, and immediately stopped us and turned us over.
What did that feel like? I can't imagine.
Well, I was knocked unconscious for a while, and I was in the back of the airplane. The other four were all thrown out through the nose of the airplane. When I came to in the back of the airplane, I wasn't completely conscious, and I could see water coming in what I thought was the bottom of the airplane. So I tried to get out there, and then come to realize the plane was upside down, and the plexiglass on the turret had shattered. And that's where the water was coming in. So I was able to go back and open the escape hatch on the bottom of the airplane, crawled out on the belly of the airplane.
Which was now the top.
Yes. And then walked back towards the tail of the airplane, and when I stepped off in the water, it was about waist deep. So I was able to wade to shore. By that time, the other four crew were already up on the shore. They were very seriously injured, and There was some people up on a bank there, and they heard the crash, so they came down there, and we didn't know if they were Chinese or Japanese, but the first thing they wanted to know, we couldn't understand it, but they pointed to the fingers on their hand, and then they pointed to each one of us, and then they pointed out to the airplane, so we figured by that they wanted to know if there was just the five of us in there. So then they helped us up to a little village there overnight.
I don't want to interrupt you here, but and I know that you, like every veteran I've interviewed, are very humble about what you did. But the government gave you a Silver Star for what you did. And tell me what you did with the other four men, because from what I've read, you had to help them significantly with first aid and making sure that they'd got off that beach.
We went down on a Japanese-occupied island off the coast of China. But the underground there helped us get out of there. And the next morning, then, none of the four of them could walk, so they had to be carried on makeshift stretchers. We had to cross the island, so they used a bamboo pallet to tie up to a bamboo pole so two coolies could carry each one of the guys on their shoulders. And the guerrilla leader on the island there, before I left, I went back to the airplane after daylight and tried to find a first aid kit. But then I saw that the airplane was upside down, the main landing gear was sticking up in the air, and the engines and propellers were quite a ways out in the water. But we must have hit the bottom when we crashed, because the whole front end of the airplane, clear back to the leading edge of the wings, was smashed flat. So if they hadn't been thrown out, they'd have never got out alive.
So were you able to find some materials to render first aid?
No, I couldn't find anything but packs of cigarettes floating around in the plane.
That might have made someone feel a little better, but it wasn't going to do a whole lot of good. So you, along with these Chinese nationals, helped the injured guys. You weren't banged up at all? I know you were just not even 21 yet, just 20 years old, but you weren't hurt at all?
I was had a pretty bad bump on the top of my head from, that's what knocked me unconscious, I guess. But otherwise than that, I was not hurt.
So what's going through your mind at this point? I mean, there are so many moments where you probably thought this could be it, but did you think you were going to get out of there alive? I mean, I can't imagine what it must have been like to you in that situation.
We didn't know if we would or not. If it hadn't been the Chinese, we'd have been captured.
How did they get you out of there and back to Allied forces?
We left that spot where we crashed at 11 o'clock in the morning. We found out later that the Japanese landed 65 Jap soldiers, and they came looking for us, but we had a head start on them. Had to go all the way across the island and went by a sampan then to the mainland. It took us 2 days to get to free territory at the little town of Haiyu on the coast. Then it took us another day to reach a hospital. They had to be carried all that time.
I imagine everyone's getting pretty exhausted and probably pretty hungry by now, too.
Well, we did have some food, but they were in pain all the time because we didn't have and had nothing to relieve their pain.
Would you say that's something, I'm sure the crew was close ahead of time, but at this point, do you think it brought the crew closer together to be going through this incredible ordeal together?
Yes, I'm sure it did, yes.
So what happened next? Where did they take you from there?
From the hospital, they got to the hospital, and there, we were there at Lin Hai for 3 days, and then another crew made a good water landing on an island out farther than we were. The airplane floated for 8 minutes, and they were able, they had the only medical doctor that was on the raid with them, and they were able to get his black bag out and get the stuff into the life raft. But in landing in the water, a sharp edge of one of the flaps had turned up. As they pushed the life raft off the wing, it punctured one half the life raft and dumped everything in the water. So they were able to cling to the raft to get ashore. And they came to the island of Dandeen where we were, and my co-pilot, Dean Davenport, had given his passport to the guerrilla leader on the island, so they knew we were ahead of them and needed medical attention. So they caught up with us at Lin Hai 3 days after we got there. And then I went on with their crew because I was no more used to my crew, and the docs twice stayed with their crew and to take care of them.
And all this time, I'm sure none of you had any idea how successful your raid was or what kind of significance it would have or what happened to all the other crews, right?
That's right. We didn't hear until we got a big city on the Yangtze River, Hanyang. We finally found out about the other crews there. So then I went on with that crew, and it took us a couple more days of pretty much walking and being carried in sedan chairs. The Chinese had blown up all the roads along the coast to slow the advance of the Japanese. So all there was trails down through the rice paddies that traveled.
This is not what you imagined when you're a Montana boy signing up for the Army Air Corps. What was that moment like when you finally saw American officers and enlisted men again and realized, you know what, I'm not going to spend the rest of this as a POW?
Well, at Lin Hai, there was an English missionary and his wife, and they could translate for us then, so that helped a lot. We finally reached Hanyang, and a good-sized city, after traveling almost every means of transportation you can think of. They had an airbase there. So we waited 3 days for an airplane to come in from Chongqing to pick us up. And those 3 days, the Japanese would come over and bomb the city and bomb the airport because the Chinese didn't have anything to shoot us at the wheel. Every day we'd go up the river in a tug and get out on the shore and hike up to a pagoda on the top of a hill there. The fourth morning they came in and picked us up, the airplane got in. Well, that day, the Japanese came over and bombed and strafed that pagoda. they knew what we were doing. They had spies through there.
Man, close call after close call after close call. And one of the things that's most incredible to me is that so many survived. There were only a few, I believe, eight ended up as prisoners of war. Three were executed by the Japanese, which is a great tragedy. But the other tragedy in this, the Chinese that helped you. I've read as many as 250,000 civilians were killed by the Japanese to punish them for helping you.
Mm-hmm. They went through, and as they kept advancing, they'd wipe out the towns and villages that helped us, any of them. Yes.
I imagine that just has to really be hard to deal with and hard to swallow, and makes you that much more grateful to those people who did help you, who saved your life. And in the end, I imagine a lot of the people that helped you probably died, right?
Yes, that's for sure. I'm sure they did, yes. Mm-hmm.
An extremely sobering reality that lingers alongside the legend of the Doolittle Raid taking place 82 years ago this week. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a few final thoughts from our archived interview with a Doolittle Raider named David Thatcher, then a World War II veteran who's still with us, one of the nurses who cared for some of the injured Raiders when they returned to the States after their heroic mission. She has quite a story about Jimmy Doolittle himself. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking the 82nd anniversary of the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. We've been listening to memories recorded years ago with David Thatcher, who was depicted by actor Robert Walker in the famous film 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. You've heard Mr. Thatcher's memories of the raid, but let's hear it in the words of the President of the United States from David Thatcher's citation for the Distinguished Flying Cross.
The President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Distinguished Flying Cross to Corporal David J. Thatcher, United States Army Air Forces, for extraordinary achievement as engineer gunner of a B-25 bomber of the 1st Special Aviation Project, Doolittle Raider Force, while participating in a highly destructive raid on the Japanese mainland on 18 April 1942. Corporal Thatcher, with 79 other officers and enlisted men, volunteered for this mission, knowing full well that the chances of survival were extremely remote, and executed his part in it with great skill and daring. This achievement reflects high credit on himself and the military service. David Thatcher also received the Silver Star for gallantry in action in his efforts to save his crewmates from the B-25 ruptured duck after it crash-landed in China. That was one of 16 B-25s on that unprecedented mission. 80 men total, 52 officers, 28 like Thatcher, enlisted men. Of that total, 3 were killed on the mission, 8 more became prisoners of war. And of those POWs, 4 died in captivity, including 3 who were executed by the Japanese.
It's been said many times that Doolittle believed, after he landed famously in a pile of dung that saved his ankle, he said that the mission was a failure because it didn't do that much damage. All the planes were lost, and he expected to be court-martialed when he got back. Was that a thought that entered any of your minds, or when you heard that he had said that, what was your reaction?
No, I'm sure it wasn't. We all figured it was a successful mission. And
when you finally did hear about what happened, about how many guys got out of there, saw how big of a deal it was for America to have that strike on Japan, did that give you a sense of pride, of accomplishment? Did that make you feel good?
Yes, it did. We just figured it was another mission. We didn't figure it would be that important.
I think it's pretty important. I think that's probably been hammered home for you many times over the years. But there's so many things I could ask you about with the other Raiders, too, some incredible stories. What are you most proud of with that group of men? And when you think about the kind of people that they were and what they represented, if you had one paragraph, a nutshell version to encapsulate the guys that you served with, what would you say?
It's been a wonderful group of men to keep track of all through the years, seeing them at the reunions.
Thank you so much for sharing those stories with us. Thank you for serving our country.
May I say some more?
You can say whatever you like.
Our oldest son was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he was killed in February 1970 at the age of 20.
And I'm sure, and I don't want to delve too deep for anything that's too painful for you, but I'm sure when that happened, it was another reminder that easily could have happened to you.
That's right, yes.
Is there anything special that you do to honor his memory that you like to share about him?
Well, his name is on the Vietnam Memorial that's here in Missoula for the state of Montana. And he's buried at the Sunset Memorial Gardens. So.
And his name is one of the more than 58,000 on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. And David Thatcher always made it clear that his son's supreme sacrifice meant more to him than any of his heroics in World War II. Again, that was our interview from years ago in Missoula, Montana, with Doolittle Raider David Thatcher. While none of the Raiders are still with us, at the California Veterans Home in Fresno, California, resides a 104-year-old named Jane Boot. That's not far from where you can find General Doolittle's actual uniform at the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. And as a nurse on the officer's ward at Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C., Jane treated some of the Raiders when they returned to the States, including David Thatcher's pilot, Ted Lawson.
Yes, Ted Lawson had, of course, Dr. White was with that raid, and he amputated Ted Lawson's leg because it was infected in China, so that he and I think another guy, Thompson, I think his name was, had dislocated shoulders, apparently had gotten, when he landed in the straps from the parachute, dislocated his shoulders. I think. So I think they were the only two patients we got from that.
I don't want to keep digging too hard, and if you're done talking about it, let me know, but I'm interested in this because you know, now, all of the Doolittle Raiders are gone. The last one died about a year ago, Dick Cole.
Yes.
But in that moment, you're seeing physically what had happened to them, but the reality was it could have been a lot worse for them. That they knew they couldn't go back to the carrier. This was
right.
A one-way mission. They didn't know what was going to happen if they landed somewhere, if they didn't get shot down in those B-25s. Did knowing what they had done, the courage that it required, did that have an effect on you as you're caring for them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We really honored, and these guys were great.
So you were talking about Ted Lawson. Do you know where he's from? Do you know where he grew up?
Yes, in California.
Right here in Fresno.
Fresno?
Yep.
I remember when his wife died, I was living in San Jose.
Now, as you're caring for these guys, do you talk to them at all about what they'd been through, or did you hear any stories about what it was like to crash land in China and try to get back?
Not really. They did not talk a lot about it. Just that, you know, it was a distressing time for them.
How severe were the injuries they were dealing with?
Yeah, I think we just had those two patients. Of course, we saw the other guys occasionally. They'd come to visit. And one of them, I think one of them had mental troubles, and they couldn't find him for a while. And Doolittle spent a lot of time finding that guy because he, you know, didn't know who he was. I guess he finally located him. I remember he was so distressed because he wasn't in uniform. Of course, by that time, he'd probably been through sets of clothes getting where he was. And he ordered new uniforms for him and even his backpack. pay. He insisted they come and give him his back pay. So I thought that was being very considerate.
Well, the other thing that comes to mind is, I mean, we know that, as you just said, that was more of a symbolic victory. It didn't devastate the enemy militarily, but it proved America can hit Japan. And there was a price that was paid for that hit on Japan, and you were looking at it. I mean, you saw this guy's life was never going to be the same. Is that and I have friends that are nurses, that they see traumatic things, I know. As a young woman, to look at someone who just gave up a piece of himself for everybody else in the country, what kind of effect does that have on you?
Well, I don't know. Of course, I really honored these guys. I said it was, I thought I was privileged to take care of them, which proved to be true.
What was your rank at the time?
I was a first lieutenant by then.
Well, the reason I ask is because I understand. You mentioned that some of the other Doolittle Raiders would come visit these guys while they were under your care. And I understand that you tried to kick a private off of the officer's ward before you found out who he really was?
He came on the ward dressed like a buck private. And I had just been assigned to the officer's ward, and I was kind of full of it. And so he was talking to another guy. Anyway, I walked up to them, and I was going to say to him, you know, why are you in this officer's ward? You know, what's your business here? And along came this guy who was a spit and polish, all dressed up in uniform and insignia and everything, calling out to, oh, and then I didn't realize who he was at first. I should have recognized him, but I didn't. I didn't expect to see him, I guess. And anyway, this guy calls out to him, oh, you know, General Doolittle, no, not at all. At the end of it, I'll be in Alaska. But he was very nice. Put his arm around my shoulder. I was just doing my duty. Very gracious guy. Of course, I got to know him quite well then. He came often to see his boys, as he called them.
Well, I guess that gives you a taste into what he must have been dealing with, too, his celebrity during this time.
Yes.
I mean, because when he gets back from that, he's given the Medal of Honor.
Right.
His picture's on the front page of every newspaper. He'd already been famous before the war as an aviator.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he felt he had to be incognito to see those guys, apparently.
Probably.
That's a pretty good claim to fame, Jane. I kicked General Doolittle out of the officer's ward, or at least tried to. Well, and you mentioned that you got to know him quite well. You know, he's someone that a lot has been written about and said about. You saw him in a time where I'm sure his heart was shining through.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you observed about Jimmy Doolittle?
He was a very humble person, really. He didn't flaunt his status or his claim to fame or anything. Seemed to be very concerned about other people, and especially his boys, and came often at night when he would be out for something else. He'd stop, see them. So I admired him a lot.
Well, I bet you also got a view of what that meant to them to have him there checking on them.
Yes. I think his men all knew that he was their prime concern.
And speaking of Ted Lawson, the plane that he flew that day was called the Ruptured Duck. They have a representation of that in Hawaii. If you go to the Pacific Aviation Museum, they have the Ruptured Duck there. But he then was the person, if I'm remembering right, wrote the book, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo.
Yes.
Which then became a movie. Were you still in the States when that was coming out, or were you already overseas?
Yeah, no, I was, I can't remember where I was, but I remember about that had come out while I was there. Yeah, I was still here.
So that must have been a little surreal to go to the movies and
what? Yes,
you had a connection to this guy.
They did a very good job. It was actually, of course, I think that Ted insisted on being kind of a director in that. He didn't want a lot of false stuff. And they did pretty well until they got to the end, and they just couldn't show a toothless Van Johnson who was playing his part. They just couldn't bring themselves to do that. But Ted, he lost all his teeth when he went through that windshield. That was the only part that really wasn't true.
Now that I hear you mentioning that, I guess I should have had you describe for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, since here's a patient you're caring for and you're informed of everything that had happened to him. Can you describe for us, as you understand it, what happened to him at the end of that mission, that one-way mission to Tokyo?
He tried to make the coast, but didn't have enough gas. So that's why he landed on the, like on the beach, but beaches aren't very good landing strips. And when he hit the beach land, sand stopped the ship and it threw him through the windshield, and that's when he lost his teeth.
So you're caring for a guy who's lost all of his teeth and lost one of his legs.
Yeah.
What were his spirits like?
Actually, he was in pretty good spirits. His wife came to see him. He didn't want her to come, but Jimmy Doolittle insisted that they bring the wives in. And he got so excited when he saw her, he jumped out of bed and fell flat on his face because he forgot he didn't have a leg.
Wow.
So, but that was true, and I reported that because I saw it.
And she is the last person alive today who can say that. Again, that was Jane Boot. You can access her complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. There are tributes to General Jimmy Doolittle and his Raiders in many places around the country. One of the most powerful is at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, where there's a bust of Doolittle right outside of Doolittle Hall, and inside an exhibit explaining several aspects of the mission, and also where some of the sports teams this year, like the Falcon baseball team right now, have worn special Doolittle Raider-themed uniforms. I think it's safe to say that General Doolittle would be pleased to know the heroes who flew that one-way mission with him 82 years ago this week have not been forgotten. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.